A month or so ago, I found myself lounging on the couch, scrolling through various newspapers, catching up on thought pieces. The leisure of the morning allowed me to read a little more widely and to follow a very few satisfying media rabbit holes. At some point in this adventure, I stumbled across an article by Jessica Bennett about the use of personal pronouns in relation to the presidential candidates. The article was titled, "She's the Next President." Wait, did you read that right? The article's main question is, could something as simple as a pronoun reflect or even affect the way voters understand power? It was a fascinating piece describing how often people cognitively stumbled when they read a short paragraph about the next president that referred to the president using the personal pronoun she. The next question, of course, is that question of electability that has been on a lot of minds in this campaign season. Could that linguistic dissonance over pronouns impact someone's willingness to vote for a woman as president? Those of you who have been following the campaigns closely know that many of the female Democratic candidates use the pronoun she when referring to the next president. And research does indicate that these linguistic issues matter, personally and organizationally. And many organizations and governments have moved to updating gendered terms, including utilizing the singular they as a gender-neutral pronoun for those who identify their gender as non-binary. This article got me to thinking more about something which I think about quite a bit, which is how do we talk and think about the pronouns that we use for God? I used to do an exercise with the confirmation class where I asked them to draw as closely as they can render their first image of what God looks like, and then to draw an image of how they imagine God looks at this stage in their faith journey. Inevitably, a majority of those first images of God is of the older white man in a robe with long flowing white hair and a full white beard. You know that image. That's always my first image as well. But as most of you know or have heard me tell tales about, I never have been one to go smoothly along with what I was told in church or in church school. Sorry, Audrey. I confess, though, that I didn't think too much about God's gender back in my childhood. I wondered idly about why more women weren't pastors and secretly longed to be closer to that role, and was fortunate enough one time to see a woman preach in my tiny home church in Westford, Pennsylvania, sometime in the 1980s. She served a much larger congregation in the thriving metropolis of Meadville, PA, population of about 15,000 people, which is why I'm sure this radical thing was allowed. You know how things are in big cities. I was in college studying religion before I really got engaged in this question about God and gender. I was fortunate that one of my professors at Teal College was a feminist scholar who brought into our classrooms a diverse amount of reading about the emerging field of feminist theology. I was 20 years old and reading theologians like Rosemary Radford Ruther and Phyllis Trible and Mary Daly, Judith Plaskow, Beverly Harrison, Elizabeth Schuessler Fiorenza, bell hooks, and Elaine Pagels. It was mind-bogglingly fun, and I sunk my teeth into all of it. But it wasn't until I got to Union Theological Seminary here in New York that I really started thinking more about gendered pronouns and how and when we use them. Union was my first encounter with an inclusive language policy in paper writing. And so I got used to using he, she, and sometimes flirted with she, he in my papers. I dove into biblical studies and learned that one of the major differences between the Revised Standard Version and the New Revised Standard Version was the broadening of more inclusive language from things like brothers in Paul's letters, for example, to brothers and sisters, and other compensations for what is described by the NRSV editors as deficiency in the English language, the lack of a common gender third person singular pronoun. I was bothered in seminary that the NRSV had taken this step in relation to people, but had not done so in relation to gender pronouns for God. This struggle was amplified by the culture at Union that beyond an inclusive language policy for papers, one did not dare in that time refer to God as he. I had more than one classmate embarrass themselves at chapel by referring to God as him or he, and being met in the service with gasps of astonishment. Frighteningly swift and persistent teasing would follow. To combat this potential humiliation and to make up for what I felt was a shortcoming by the NRSV editors not taking things far enough, I began to train myself to neutralize the gender pronouns for God. I have several Bibles from that era with my notes as I worked through various options to equip myself to do this respectfully and smoothly with the biblical texts. When I started working here, I began to hone that practice, especially during midweek, Wednesday evening services, when we used to read a lot of Psalms. Psalms lend themselves easily to this practice. And on Sunday mornings, at least for a while, I was less consistent, until a number of years ago, falling pretty consistently into the pattern of removing those pronouns. A few questions emerged about this practice of mine over the years, but what caught my ear was something that happened a few months ago. We had a particularly he-him oriented reading for the second lesson that I was reading one morning, and without thinking much about it until I stepped up to the lectern and groaned inwardly a bit, my earlier read-through, I hadn't noticed how many male pronouns there were. But in this case, practice paid off, and I managed my way through the lesson speaking no male pronouns. It was the first time in all of my years reading scripture that way here that people at the door mentioned how much they appreciated my avoiding the male gender pronouns. All of these comments were from women. These were not questions. They were simple, observational expressions of gratitude. Some of you are here today. But those grateful women got me to thinking. One thing I thought about was how I make this neutralizing of God's gender a practice, but I've never really talked with you all about that practice, except perhaps idly at Bible study over the years. I thought about how this practice is not really uniform here, nor has it ever been. I heard John Walton on a few occasions refer to God as she in general, and in general, he was a master of words, and he was careful and inclusive with his pronouns, as Bob always is, and Audrey, and Mark, and Hannah Faye. I'm not advocating that it needs to be unified in our practice here. It's more an observation about what is comfortable for us as a community. Whenever I stand up and read a passage, even like the one about Lady Wisdom that Dave read for us this morning, I wonder what you will hear. What is your vernacular about God? One would think that after 20 plus years, I would know your colloquial speech as well as anyone. Perhaps I do. And yet every time I stand in front of you, I'm always making choices about how my vernacular meets yours. Aren't we all? When I stand in front of you, I'm also always the girl who was in speech therapy in elementary school for my stutter. I'm also the young woman who spoke familial over colloquial language and was teased lovingly, but unmercifully for it by my high school classmates. And if I'm really tired, you will hear me say, "Warsh," instead of wash, even though this is a word that I have practiced more than any other word in my vocabulary. I mention this aspect not to elicit your sympathy, but to emphasize that words matter. And these days, we know this especially to be true. I like how the poet Tony Hoagland puts it. He says, "We use our vernaculars in the way that animals deploy various smells and glands to tell each other who we are and who we are with. Or conversely, maybe we use it the way chameleons use color to blend in." And perhaps this is how it is with gender pronouns for God. Who are we with? And what are the costs and benefits of blending in? I thought about the idea that I could have years ago solved how I wanted to speak about God's gender in other ways and with other choices. The New Testament scholar Elaine Pagels describes these choices well in her analysis of how other early Christian texts describe God. She suggests that some maintain that the divine is to be considered masculo-feminine, the great male-female power, while others insist that terms are meant as metaphors, for in reality, the divine is neither masculine nor feminine. While a third group of those early Christian writers suggests that one can describe the source of all things in either masculine or feminine terms, depending on which aspect one wants to stress. So, in terms of how we use these pronouns, there are choices. There is both. There is neither and either. But if postmodernity has taught us anything, it is perhaps we don't have to choose one method for every occasion, and maybe we can embrace the variety that we may need at any given time. For instance, like many of you, I love the King James Version of Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He. One of my favorite hymns as a child was "This is my Father's World." I still love that hymn. I love the gender neutral language for God because it makes me less lazy. I have to really imagine, who is this God that I'm reading with right now? I like feminine imagery for God because it challenges me to be open to God's abundant identity. God is like a mother hen gathering her chicks, Jesus says. I also got to thinking about how questions of my youthful theological study are still swirling these days and shifting to consider not just the gender of God, but also of Jesus. It was Rosemary Radford Ruther who, in her now classic book, Sexism in God Talk, in 1983 asked, "Can a male savior save women?" That question may cause some eye rolling even today, but hang in there with me, because in reality, Ruther's argument is that Jesus' maleness has been given enormous theological importance within the history of Christianity, often being used to suggest that only men can represent Christ in the clergy. So you might scoff and think that us Protestants don't have that problem, but in reality, the issues raised earlier about how women are seen in leadership are real issues, even for those of us who are ordained clergy. A new wave of theologians are challenging, not that Jesus was incarnate in a male body, but that Christ can be seen as a multi-gendered body. It's interesting, right? In today's world, we have more public discourse than ever before about gender as a social construct, and we are developing agility with language about binary gender terms and the fluidness of gender. In an article written now 10 years ago, New Testament scholar Candida Moss wrote about Jesus and the woman with the flow of blood that Audrey read for us today. Moss draws on the Hellenistic ideas of the body that were sharply delineated. Male bodies were understood as hard and sturdy and unyielding, while female bodies were soft and porous, leaky, as Moss puts it. She goes on to argue that in this passage from Luke's community, it's not only the woman's body that is conspicuously leaky, but also Jesus' body. I'm sorry for those of you who are squeamish, but Jesus doesn't seem to control the power that seeps out of him to heal this woman. His leaky body mirroring her own, and modeling that perhaps Jesus gives us more layers of gender diversity than we have been taught over the years. There are many more examples, but for today, on this International Women's Day, on this second Sunday of Lent, our challenge is how we cannot give up the openness we need to receive this more gender diverse idea of the divine. Is it important to all of us, or just to some of us? With all the problems in the world today, this issue may seem like one that could be prioritized behind so many others. And yet I commend to your attention that it is vitally important. My doctoral program at Fordham, we talked about the significance of linguistic resistance. Make no mistake, words make a difference. And furthermore, the operative question may be an echo of a phrase that Jesus uses in the Gospel of Matthew: does it matter to the least of these? Indeed, yes. We are raising sons and daughters in this world, a world that desperately needs kind, thoughtful leaders, no matter what their gender. In Friday's Wall Street Journal podcast, The Journal, my friend Kate Linebaugh laid out an interesting new research that women not advancing in the workplace may have less to do with what's happening at home, the conventional reasoning for this, and much more to do with what actually happens in the workplace. While women earn a majority of college degrees and make up over half of the workforce, less than 6% of those women go on to become CEOs. That is not enough. It is not enough that there were 6 women candidates running for president in this campaign cycle within the Democratic Party, and yet this morning, none remain. It is significant that there is still a cognitive stumble when we hear the word she attached to certain roles, especially roles that include power, our president, our CEO, our clergy, our God. We are a congregation that strives to welcome women in leadership in all aspects of our life together. And so we must consider if our pronouns limit us. We are a congregation that strives to welcome those in the transgender community and those who are non-binary. And yet we must recognize that we must always improve our word choices, our hospitality, and so we must consider if our pronoun choices, even for God, especially for God, limit us. The openness that we practice during this Lenten season is exercising that can make us more flexible, like yoga or qigong or running or choir rehearsal or soccer practice. The practices of openness are not just about the word hospitality. Our practices of openness are about how we choose words that shape and reshape our own experiences of God. That in practicing, we stop spiritually stumbling over a God who is too small for a church that we are called to be. So in this season of Lent, I invite you to join me in this practice of openness, to let God's abundant diversity, to let them, to let her grow in our hearts and our minds.